Welcome to Season 3 of Instant Coffee. I'm Nadine Almanasfi.
And I'm Sima Shihab.
And this latest season is an exploration of technology and its developments in the region.
Beyond the emergence of ChatGPT and Sophia the Robot, we wanted to speak with people who are applying, adapting, and reimagining technology in their fields.
We will be exposed to medieval Islamic hospitals, failed Gulf techno cities, emerging Iraqi fintech startups, inclusive artificial intelligence, and much more.
In this episode, we speak to two individuals engaging in capacity building in Iraq and Iran, specifically in relation to fintech. Ali Al-Hilli is a tech entrepreneur from Iraq with over 14 years of experience in business development, telecommunications, and fintech.
Shayan Iskandari is a PhD candidate from Iran with a background in blockchain engineering. He is actively involved in creating and supporting open source projects related to cryptocurrencies.
Their different approaches to utilizing technologies in the quest for financial sovereignty and giving back to their home countries provides a really expansive definition of fintech itself.
Hi Ali, thanks for taking the time to speak with us. Can you tell us a bit more about yourself and your work background in relation to Iraq's startup and fintech scene?
Okay, so my name is Ali Al-Hilli. I'm heading the marketing communications at Miswak, the oldest homegrown and largest homegrown startup in the country. It is focused on e-commerce in general. It was recently got invested by one of the major fintech companies in Iraq. I've been in working with tech and entrepreneurial ecosystem for the past 8 years in the country, in Iraq. In the beginning, I was part of developing the communities that will be working on kicking off this kind of ecosystem from telecom to fintech. And then I landed at Miswak. I helped Miswak go into the next phase, that is raising Series A investment. With my own expertise, network, and communications, I would be part of the team to do the investment raising.
So when did fintech really start to emerge and develop in Iraq?
Basically, there was no fintech scene in the previously in the country. Iraq was under the Article 7 from the United Nations.
Can you explain what Article 7 is briefly?
Article 7 is some sort of a sanction from the Security Council due to the invasion of Kuwait in 1991. Iraq has a lot of debts due to the international community and especially Kuwait, the invaded country. There was some sort of oversee and monitoring over Iraq's financial transactions. So there was no activity for companies like MasterCard and Visa in the country. They started operating in Iraq like 7 or 6 years ago. MasterCard was introduced to the Iraqi market first, and then Visa followed. Prior to that, and even to this day, most of Iraq's economy is a cash economy. It is not so well advanced or well equipped in terms of e-payment. Back then, some companies tried to find local solutions to print and distribute cards, do some kind of points of cash. We call them point of cash because this is an Iraqi invention to substitute ATMs. Today, Iraq's network of cash out is 99% is cash out agents rather than ATMs. We don't have a lot of ATMs in the country. By 2016 and 2017, the scene has changed. MasterCard and Visa entered the country and financial inclusion was very much supported by the government and the international community. And things started moving forward from that on.
And what can we see now in terms of fintech activity? I'm thinking particularly from the younger generation in Iraq.
We have started seeing a vibrant entrepreneurial ecosystem that is basically growing toward creating more founders, startups, SMEs, and even a skilled force to go to even the financial institutions and work there. It is not only a startup and a new venture and a new service. It's even the current old-fashioned private sector that we have. For instance, if you look for an AML expert, anti-money laundering expert, they don't have enough experience in the market because the market is new. So how many banks have been working on decent training for their employees about AML and a lot of other skills and activities? Past COVID, we started seeing trends expanding in digital commerce in terms of e-commerce, quick commerce, and social commerce.
And what do these increased trends in digital commerce look like on the ground?
If I talk about the digital commerce in general, we are growing, the market is growing by 27% on an annual basis. A lot of growth is happening into the grocery and beverages and food delivery services. So, and the market is growing more than the growth is happening in the user base. That means the users are doing more transactions throughout these kind of apps. Since 2017, Careem entered the market and then followed by recently by Talabat. So that means the market is currently being overseen by regional players, regional companies, and definitely regional investors and VCs who will be coming to see the potential of a 42 million Iraqi market. Even if I look at the financial sector in the Pacific, I would see more than 16 million issued cards in the country between retirees, government sector employees, private sector employees, and the young generation. That means a lot of business cases to be created on the supply side of this equation. And this is taking place this year by even the government is focusing on distributing point of sales in public institutions. We started seeing restaurants adopting this kind of e-payment. And it is still very slow on the whole vertical value chain of, let's say, the hospitality and restaurants industry, but it is being adopted in a good pace.
And so you mentioned the regional element, which is something that we did want to discuss. Where is investment going in the region more broadly?
When you look at the whole region's fintech growth of 36%, you would see, even in terms of investment, you see in 2020, the investment in fintech was around $200 million across the region, while today it's almost $900 million. How much money, or what is the percentage of that was invested in Iraq? Maybe less than 5% or 4%. The Emirates have 25%, Saudi Arabia around 15%. You see Egypt 20%. You see even Pakistan with 5%. But Iraq does not need a lot of investments right now because it is starting from zero. You know, when you start from zero and then after a very small period of time, you see your growth rate, it's in hundreds of percents because you are starting from zero.
This situation you've described of Iraq being a cash-only economy, it's a bit difficult to grasp considering our complete reliance on cards and e-payments, but could you describe what it really means for a country to be cash-only? I mean, what kind of effect would this have and what effect is it still having on Iraq?
You know, okay, the thing is, when people are afraid to put their cash anywhere, this cash is never traced and recorded. Thus, there is no credit lines and credit histories for these people to get some kind of loans and other financial products. And this would cripple the economy cycle to get these kind of cash streams back into the economy. At the same time, when people don't give banks enough deposits, banks will definitely be crippled in loaning or even investing in different bonds and other stuff. So having the critical cash mass under the floor in my house would mean there is no healthy economic cycle on both individuals and SMEs. And by definition, this would cripple the GDP, so it will cripple a lot of the government's efforts to enhance its economy.
Ali talked us through Iraq's contemporary economic history briefly, highlighting where the cash mistrust came from.
So the 70s and the beginning of the 80s were the prosperous periods of the Iraqi economy and the Iraqi even political scene. So the people had a lot of savings in their bank accounts, and then hyper devaluation happened and a lot of people lost so much money in the bank. So they started de-trusting banks, putting their money in. Later on in the early 2000s, the new central bank was formed in 2004 with its new regulations, a new passed law by the government at that time. And it did not work on getting back the trust of the population. Rather than a lot of different incidents that was accompanied by some sort of a civil war in Iraq in 2005, 2006, and 2007, led to robberies in banks, a lot of bad deeds, bad things happened by bankers that led to a second distrust in the banking sector. So people started moving toward exchange offices and transfer companies. So there was this kind of a company licensing in Iraq that was not there in the world. There were banks and there were transfer companies. It is not there anymore. There we have banks and we have non-banks institutions or financial institutions doing different kind of role in the country. So people started putting their money in the exchange offices and these company transfer companies because they always have cash. They open throughout the weekend. They open until very late at night. So it started becoming a more trustworthy institutions. In the past 15 years, maybe, or 20 years, Iraq was not stable politically. You know, we have seen the American invasion 2003, followed by 2.5 years of civil war, followed by some political unrest, and then ISIS. And this there was the uprising of 2019. All of these were walls against regional and foreign investment to the country. In addition to some old-fashioned legislations that don't protect these kind of investors in the country. But since last year, things are moving forward in a different direction, like when the Saudis, the Emirates, and Qatari governments are pledging investments to the country that would need less tight regulations to protect the interests of these investors in general in terms of government sovereign funds and the individual investors. So it is the natural progress that we are reaching this phase, and we are reaching this phase actually quickly. 4 years ago, or 5 years ago, we were still fighting ISIS. When I talk about after 5 years, I can see these numbers in terms of growth, in terms of adaptability to e-payment, in terms of more applications being used, in terms of digital transactions, different regulations, changes in the e-payment system and in general in the investment scene. And we have welcomed VCs like Plastics Labs who have visited in March. It's a regional VC, and ABX, Arab Bank Accelerator, is entering and investigating the fintech realm of the startup ecosystem. That means we are on the radar now.
Ali speaks passionately about this rapid development of the startup and fintech ecosystem in Iraq. It's clear that the interests of both individual Iraqis and the thriving of the state of Iraq are important to the support, work, and mentorship he provides. We wanted to explore another way that individuals in the region are trying to regain financial sovereignty through technology, something that sits both within and outside the realm of fintech, that is the world of cryptocurrencies. These alternative currencies and the innovative technological system it's created are becoming increasingly popular in the region, with MENA becoming the world's fastest growing crypto market in 2022, according to a study from blockchain researcher Chain Analysis. Egypt, Saudi, Lebanon, Morocco, and UAE top the list in terms of crypto transaction volume. But Iran is an interesting country to look at considering the reason why cryptocurrencies have emerged and are used by its citizens.
So that's the beauty of it. That's like as long as...
We spoke to Shayan Iskandari, who is a PhD candidate at Concordia University. He founded the NGO Iran Unchained and has been working on nonprofit educational content in Farsi on the topic of blockchain and cryptocurrencies for over a decade. We started first by asking him about this unique position cryptocurrency has in relation to fintech.
On fintech, there should be a startup, there should be entrepreneurs, they should get like regulatories, banking system, they need all the approvals. On the cryptocurrency side, it's just anyone can start a service or a coin or whatever they want to do. And as long as they get network support, they get like people in, they can basically use that service. On my end, like in around 2012, 2013, I was reading about Bitcoin and it was like, this too good to be true. I was like, it doesn't work. Like it can't work. So I spent like around 6 months trying to break it. And it was like, no, it wouldn't work. And I joke around that like it broke me and I switched my topic of thesis to like Bitcoin usability and whole my world changed to like working on cryptocurrencies. And the main difference is like the way to describe what Bitcoin is in a simple term is imagine a permissionless a system of money that you don't need to ask anyone's permission to use, and no one can come to you and be like, you can't use this service for any reason. Even you can be a machine, you can be a computer that can use the service without any identity.
And how did you get into crypto, Cheyenne?
As someone that grew up in Iran inside the sanctions, I had a lot of these questions sometimes that like, I want to do something and I couldn't. And I was like, why? Like, I don't know why I can't use the service. And Bitcoin was too beautiful early on when I learned about this. What happened was like in Iran, they started like, there was like a shoe company in Isfahan, like was selling leather shoes internationally using Bitcoin. There was like a rapper in Mashhad that was like selling his songs online using Bitcoin. These are like 2012, 2013, like really early on. A few exchanges started and then they kind of went down. Like it was like a battle between a lot of like the government side and these exchanges, because they're, especially governments like Iran, they don't want another monetary service system to be unparalleled inside the country. It's funny to say, so Iran government, Russia, China, they have like love and hate relationship with Bitcoin things, because Bitcoin can solve a lot of their problem, but they don't want the people to like bypass them. In Iran, Bitcoin mining became kind of illegal for a while. And then they were like, no, you can ask for permission of it, like to like get the licenses. But one interesting thing that you can search online, see one of the videos, people started saying that like, and at their local mosques, they're hearing this like sound. And it was because mosques get like free electricity. And people were mining in mosques because like the electricity was free. But it grew like there was a group called Coin Iran, which started like a nonprofit educational website. I joined them to like create a podcast on this end. And it's interesting that we ended up having a fan base that we're not even aware of, because they were learning about the technology. They were learning about this and they started doing their own things. A lot of universities started having a research group on this. It kind of grew, like a lot of people started using this as money. But something happened around like three years ago called airdrops, which was one of the main reasons a lot of people got into crypto. And what airdrops was like still happening. It's like a lot of people that were using a protocol or using a service that didn't have a coin itself were like using it. And after a while, the service was like, here, we're going to have our own coin. And to all the users that have been using our protocol, here's some coin. Okay, airdrop, like giving everyone some coin. And one of the first is an exchange, decentralized exchange called Uniswap, because it was like around $10,000, like airdrop. And it was like, it's a life-changing money. So a lot of people... A job kind of came out of this called airdrop hunting, which people are influencers. They give like information to others, signal and like what protocol might have a next airdrop. So let's use it. It fascinates me that like we spend like so much time, like 5 years trying to educate people about this technology, how to have a wallet, how to use it, what are the protocols. And we got a few people in, a lot of like more masters and PhD levels. But airdrop hunting, because it became a job, people started using different wallets, different protocols, trying different things. And it was fascinating to see that volume coming from Iran. And a lot of people made a lot of money. A lot of people learned how to use this. A lot of people also end up having wallets.
That's really fascinating. I mean, this idea of total control and privacy seems like it would appeal to a larger segment of the population. Did you see anyone beyond doctoral students wanting to engage with this training you were providing?
It's interesting, like, so I used to have this company in Iran, which was like Apple, like Apple support, fixing iPhones. And one of the early customers that we started seeing Bitcoin wallets on were mostly like young women. And we kind of were like, wondering like, how is that possible? Like, we've seen like really geeky nerds having it and young women. And we realized that some of them are like sex workers or some other thing, that because when they get arrested, everything they have are seized. But if they have Bitcoin, they can just easily delete the app, have the backup somewhere, and no one can take their money. I have my Bitcoin address, but if I don't tell anyone my Bitcoin address, no one knows I have Bitcoin. That is me. And usually for the backup is like you can get 12 words. Like if you write down to those 12 words, you can always restore access to your address. And the same, if you lose it, no one can restore your account. You lost your money. So it's like, it's all on you. The other thing you're seeing is like I know a lot of freelance workers early on, especially like designers, which were there a lot of women, like girls were doing online designs, freelance work and getting paid with Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies, because just no one could pay them if outside Iran, right? Like some people start using like PayPal, but PayPal, as soon as you, there is a leakage of your RP, there is a sign that you're from Iran, your account is suspended without any way to get it back.
And you've done a lot of outreach and support work in Iran. What kind of crypto work are you engaging with at the moment?
A few years ago, we started this group called Women in Blockchain Farsi, which like seven Iranian women started that. I was basically mentoring them. I usually say I'm the guy in Women in Blockchain Farsi. One thing I love is like they started as they were asking me these questions. I'm like, if we learn this programming language, if we learn this technology, would anyone hire us? What degrees we should get? Like these kind of questions. And basically I was telling them like, learn about this and find what part you're passionate about and just continue there. Like you'll find something that you've never knew it existed before. That was like 3 years ago. We did like an online course. They helped me like instruct the whole course online. We did that 2 years ago and we did it again this summer. We got more than 2,000 students. Imagine like Farsi, programming on blockchain, 2,000 students, which is kind of overwhelming as like you got a lot more work there. But one thing I love to that I see is like they have this Women in Blockchain Farsi. They have like these weekly meetings. They do code auditings. One of them from like a rural areas in Iran. And she was saying that like her husband after work, when he comes home, they sit together, read code and find like discuss and find bugs. And it's fascinating to see that like that dynamic emerge from like just a technology, like, right? Like it changed the family dynamics because like they have something that they're passionate about, both of them, and they can talk about it, right?
That is a really nice outcome of yeah, like a positive use of technology. Can you talk to us a bit more about Iran Unchained?
Last year, when this Women Life Freedom movement started with Mahsa Amini, there was like a lot of people inside Iran trying to do like pro-democracy work or like internet freedom work. And one thing that US Treasury did was removed sanctions from a bunch of specific items. One, like anything for internet freedom, anything for secure communication. Like if you're providing like free internet or VPNs or education for fighting digital illiteracy or like things like added an exceptions to like US entities that they can offer this to Iranians now and they're not sanctioned. But what happened was like banks still over comply. We couldn't still send money to Iran. And me and a few other like diaspora, we were like, all right, now legally it's okay. So if we get a good lawyer to figure this out, we can use crypto and like cryptocurrencies to help these entities. So that's where we started this NGO called Iran Unchained, which the goal was like kind of a grant platform, but all focused on this women life freedom movement. One of the main things we helped a lot was like humanitarian aid, sending like food packages around Iran or VPN access. That's like one of the bigger things. And it's been working. Like it's spent a lot of money on the legal side, but it's working. And that's one of the ways. So it's not necessarily evading sanctions, it's complying with sanctions by sending the money in the right way, like legal way. Because still like banks over comply. And it's like, even if you say you're talking about Iran, they might close your account.
What's clear from our conversation with Cheyenne is that citizens will and have been finding novel ways of circumventing sanctions to support causes they care about in their home countries. And financial technologies are providing useful means of support. Our conversation with Ali took place in September 2023. At that time, Iraq was facing new financial regulations from the US Treasury. Ali spoke to us about the effect of these regulations, which he was also looking at in an enthusiastic light.
With the current last few months sanctions or new regulations by the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department towards some banks, the financial sector is being a little bit more regulated. And with this more regulation and monetary, it would produce the right products, well-calculated, well-presented products, financial products to the market. With this comes more maybe innovation, and innovation would attract investment. Innovation means investment.
So are you saying that the sanctions are actually helping?
Yes. Why is that? Because if we go back to the story in 2013, 2014, when these transfer companies were transformed into banks, their functions was not banks. What happened in Iraq for the past 10 years was either payroll and inclusion for the payroll from the public and private side and retirees toward having cards and using the points of cash network, or the dollar auction. That is the mechanism that Iraq uses to exchange the dollars Iraq gets from oil exports with Iraqi dinars that in the market, so Iraq's government can pay the salaries. In between, there was no well-structured corporate banking, retail banking, investment banking. We were missing a lot. A lot of our banks were either working on the payroll or working on the dollar auction. So with sanctions, to access the dollar through the dollar auction means banks either have to follow the regulations more to not to be sanctioned, one, and two, to start diversifying their portfolio for other services, corporate banking, retail banking. And this would help startups, would help SMEs, would help even big corporations to get better banking services, and definitely would help through retail banking. It would help individuals get some products that can increase the level of life quality in these cities.
So I just wanted to come back to this idea of rapid development, because as you said, Iraq has really gone through so much in the past few years. Can you not see a case of uneven development in all of this?
I'm part of the WSA, the World Summit Award community, that is an award under the patronage of the United Nations. My counterparts from India have been talking about the same issue, that the more we go digitized, the more we are creating segregation between digitized people and undigitized people. And this will create a vacuum in the middle. The same thing definitely happens in Iraq. You see a lot of cities, the capital, Baghdad, is inhabited by 25%, almost 25% of the population. You will see a northern capital, that is Erbil, the capital of Kurdistan region. And then you will see Basra, that is the main exporter for oil. It's the port, it's the lung of Iraq. Then you would see cities like Mosul, that was heavily destroyed by ISIS and the liberation activities. And you see cities like Muthanna / Samawa, the governorate and the main city, they have more than 70% unemployment rate in the young generations. Definitely you would see this indifference between the country, but there was this kind of issue with the cash economy in Iraq. Iraq has, for the past 20 years, it was scoring record scores in terms of corruption scale. Digitizing the e-payment would make it more transparent to the government, make it more understandable to the government with the payment patterns, the amounts. And then this would help the government reduce corruption in general. So by reducing corruption, every single city in Iraq would be benefited, even if it's not 100% digitized. So yes, there are the pros and cons, but I do believe that the pros are more than the cons.
And so what are your thoughts on the future of startups and of fintech in Iraq? Are you excited?
Numbers are very promising. We are seeing not only solutions by big corporations are being adopted by the market, but even for startups, very small startups who are providing solutions for social commerce in general. What is social commerce? Is actually selling products through social media. And since Iraq was introduced to the internet by 2003 and 2004, in a wider range. And then in 2005, the social media revolution started. And then we only had 4G for the past 2 years. All of these elements made people leapfrog e-commerce towards social commerce. And 99% of the digital commerce market today happens on social media, specifically Facebook and Instagram. And they need these kind of tools to get their e-payments. How a Facebook page would sell on e-payment. And you would say, digital wallets are flourishing in this area. You would say a lot of entrepreneurial and small startups are flourishing in this area, and they are opening up to banks and financial institutions for some kind of licensing support. So it's already there. The numbers are moving positively quickly.
Thank you so much for speaking to us, Ali, and for sharing with us this small but vibrant startup ecosystem in Iraq. And it's really great to hear from someone so passionate about helping their country. So we really wish you all the best with your work in the future.
It is marvelous. What's happening in the country right now is marvelous. We are witnessing a whole build-up to the country. Now we have the issues of the climate change, because Iraq is one of the top five countries that are affected by that. We don't produce climate change increase in the temperature, but we are only affected. And with this started coming solutions for renewable energy, solutions that was cascaded down for e-payment, cascaded down for e-commerce, cascaded down for a lot of areas. So it is very interesting times to be living and working in Iraq. You don't tend to have this window of opportunity to see country being reconstructed digitally and non-digitally at the same time in your lifetime.
Thank you for listening to Instant Coffee, a podcast brought to you by the LSE Middle East Center. Join us every other Tuesday for a new episode. To learn more about Haleh, Shayan, and their work, follow the links in the podcast description. And don't forget to follow us on your favorite streaming platforms.